The topic, as you can see at the top of the source sheet, is Og Melech HaBashan, and he occupies a position of indispensable importance in the narrative of the Torah. I am not exaggerating or overstating when I say that a proper understanding of Og is the key to a proper understanding of the enterprise of Torah generally. It seems like a very extreme statement, but I hope to share a perspective with you which will support that statement. So let's begin by shifting our attention from Og for a few minutes to what is perhaps the most fundamental question that must be addressed if we are to grasp the meaning of Torah in our lives. It's a deceptively simple question. What is the relationship between physicality and spirituality? The classic question, the relationship between Gashmius and Ruchnius. Is the relationship an adversarial relationship? These two things are in conflict one with the other. Or is it a mutual relationship in which they complement each other? And is the relationship one of antagonists, or is it what we would call a symbiotic relationship, a relationship that creates synergy? There's another way of putting the question, which is, what is the relationship between Olam Hazeh and Olam Haba? Same question. Is Olam Hazeh a static stage on which we play out an elaborate and ritualized game of overcoming challenges in this world, in order that we may earn a place in Olam Haba? Or is Olam Hazeh a field of dynamic opportunity on which we create our identity and therefore our own unique Olam Haba? Now I want to consider with you a third way of asking this question. And this version of the question will bring us back to Og. The Gemara in Sanhedrin, which is the first source on the sheet, tells a story that occurred on the sixth day of creation, the day of the creation of Adam. Amar Rav Yehuda Amar Rav, B'shoa Shabikesh HaKadosh Baruch Hu Livros Es HaAdam, Bora Kat Achas Shal Malochei HaShoreis. So Omar Lohem, Ritzonchem Nase Odom Bitzalmenu. So he asked the Malochim, is it your will that we should create Odom? Which, by the way, as mentioned as an aside, this Medrash, as well as this Gemara, as well as others, is the basis of the fact that Nase Odom Bitzalmenu is a question. It's not a declaration. You could learn the words Nase Adam Bitzalmenu as a tzivui. Let us make man, which is the way it's generally translated. Let us make man, Nase Adam. But you see from the Gemara that it was a question that HaKadosh Baruch Hu posed. Shall we make man? Nase Adam. That in itself is worth, that's a sheer word unto itself. The implications of Nase Adam as a question as opposed to a declaration. However, so they answer, Amr Lefonov, Ribono Shalolam, Ma Ma'asov, what's he going to do? Amr Lohem, Kach V'Kach Ma'asov. He's going to do all kinds of things. Some of them are going to be good, some of them are going to be bad. So they answered, if that's the case, if he's going to have some Chatoyim as well, then Amr Lefonov, Ribono Shalolam, Ma Enosh Kisis Kerenu, Ven Adam Kisif Kedenu. So the answer, they say, no. They quote the Pasuk in Tehillim, so to speak. Mo'enosh kisis karenu. What is man that you should be mindful of him, that you should remember him? So therefore, what did God do? Hoshit etzvo kitana b'neim v'sorfom. He put his little finger between these angels and burned them up. V'chein katshniya. Same thing happens with a second set of angels. So at this point, the angels wise up. And when he has the katshlishis, omru lefanav, ribono shel olam, rishonim shomru lefanecha maho ilu. The first two groups, they didn't get very far with their statement to you. So, kol olam kulo shelcho, kol mashata rotzel asos, kol olam chase. You do whatever you want. We're not getting involved. Now, a similar scene occurs at Har Sinai. And this is the second source on the sheet. And the Gemara in Shabbos this time tells this story. Gemara says, Omer Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, b'shoshola moshel amorom, omru malachei hashores, lifnei hakadosh baruch hu, ribono shel olam, mal yiludi isha b'neinu. What is this person born of woman doing amongst us? Omer lehem lekabel Torah bo. So omru lefanava. Are you kidding? You're joking. Chamuda genuza, she genuza lecha teisha meos v'shivim v'arbo doros kodem shenivra olam. This precious Torah, the adored and precious Torah, the chamuda genuza, was created 974 generations before the world. Atomavakeish litno lebosar v'dam. You want to give it to human beings? Again, the same pasuk. Mo enosh kisis karenu, uven adam kisif kedenu. And they further say, Hashem Adonenu, mo adir shimcha b'chol ha'aretz asher tinoh udcha l'ashamayim. How formidable is your name throughout the world? You should rather confer your hod, your glory, upon Shamayim. Don't leave the Torah with us. Don't give it to them. In both of these incidents, the Gemara in Sanhedrin, the Gemara in Shabbos, the Malachei Hashoreis ask precisely our fundamental question. Why give the Torah to human beings with their physical brains and bodies? Men are nothing but bosor, their meat, their brains are meat. What are you giving to them? Instead, confer your glory on the Shamayim. Give it to us. We are entirely spiritual, entirely ruchni. Why are you getting involved with gashmi creations? The angels say, what happened to the Torah that predates the insignificant world of men? The Torah that is described in the Yerushalmi as a shchor al gabei yesh levana. That Torah is severely diminished by reducing it. By giving it to human beings, you're reducing it to a local covenant that applies on a tiny rock adrift in the vastness of space. It is totally insignificant. The world and the men who live on it. Why are you getting involved with that? Now, you'll notice HaKadosh Baruch Hu never answered the angels during the millennia that followed the sixth day of creation. His only response was to burn them up. But the story told in the Gemara and Shabbos at Har Sinai, when Moshe went up to get the Torah, that story has a different ending. Moshe is told to answer the Malachim. So let's read source number 3. Let's read what he said. So Omar lo Moshe la HaKadosh Baruch Hu. I'm sorry, Omar lo HaKadosh Baruch Hu Moshe. Hachzer lahem tshuva. Give him an answer. Omar lefanov. Ribono shel olam shatanosen, Torah shatanosen li maksiv ba. So God answers, Anochi Hashem Elokecha asher hotzeisicha me'aretz Mitzrayim. So Amar Lohem, Moshe says to the Malachim, Lemitzrayim yiradetem, Leparo hishtabadetem, Torah lamateilochem. Did you experience Mitzrayim? You went through Shibud? What do you need the Torah for? Then Moshe says, Shuv maksivba. Give me another example of what's in the Torah. So God answers, Lo yelecha Elohim acherim. So Moshe turns to the angels and says, Bein amim atem shruyim shovdim avoras gilulim. You live among nations that worship idols, that you need to be told, don't worship idols? Give me another, Shuv maksivba. God answers, Zocharas yom ha-shabbos lekadsho. Moshe says to the angels, Kol matem osim melacha, shatem tzrichim shavus. You don't do any melacha, so what do you need Shabbos for? Shuv maksivba, lo sisa. Don't swear in court falsely when you have a court case. So Moshe says to them, Masa umaton yesh beinechem. Why do you need the Torah? Shuv maksivba, kabedas avicha v'yasom yedazimecha. And he says, Avoim yesh lachem. You have mothers, you have fathers. Shuv maksivba, lo sirtzach, lo sinof, lo signof. And Moshe says, Kino yesh beinechem, yetzer hara yesh beinechem. Why do you need these mitzvahs? You're not subject to jealousy, yetzer hara. Miyad hodulo lakodesh baruch hu. The malachim hear these gewaldige answers, and they say, oh, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you're right. Shenemar, Hashem Adonenu, ma adir shimcha b'chol ha'oretz. Your adirus should be conferred on the oretz. V'ilu, t'noho t'chal ha'shamayim loksiv. Now they're no longer saying, confer your hod on the shamayim. Al ha'oretz. And miyad, not only that, not only did they agree that Moshe was correct, but miyad kol echod v'echod nase lo ohev. They all became Moshe's lovers. Umosar lo dovar, and each one gave him a gift. Shenemar olisa l'amorom, you went up on high. Shavisa shevi, you took captives. Lokachta matanos ba'odom, and you took gifts as a result of being odom. Ba'odom. Bischar shekra'ucha odom, because they called you odom, lokachta matanos. Now, when you think about this a little bit, Moshe's answer is rather weak and unconvincing, because all of his answers actually sound like an affirmation of the question that the angels asked. Their question was, why give a limited Torah in a local context to limited creations? That was the question. Moshe doesn't address the angels' argument. For example, Moshe asks, were they slaves in Egypt? No. This goes to the heart of their question. The angels contended that Yetzias Mitzrayim was an insignificant local event on a tiny planet. The angels' argument is, the Chamuda Genuza is the blueprint for the entire universe, for galaxies and galaxies. And you, Moshe, point to a bunch of nomads turned slaves on some pathetic rock somewhere in some far-off galaxy. Every one of Moshe's examples is subject to the same ridicule. Yet, for some mysterious reason, the angels are deeply impressed. They fall in love with Moshe. They shower him with gifts. Now, mind you, this is the only answer ever offered to the angels' contention. Mo enosh kisis kirenu, t'nohotcha al hashamayim. Moshe must have persuasively argued that the Torah, in a local context, is a more valuable Torah. That a Torah given to this people on this earth adds value to the Torah. And therefore he took it captive and earned the admiration of the angels. He earned their love. He does this by demonstrating conclusively that the meaning and value of Torah lie in the trivial examples that he gives. But the Gemara doesn't explain why this is the case. Why? And this is no small issue. It's no small issue because the Mabul resulted from a similar incident. Now, this incident is shrouded in mystery. It's one of the most puzzling stories in the Torah, subject to many interpretations. I know that one of the calling cards of the yeshiva is that you read psukim very carefully. You learn to be very critical readers of psukim. And that's a wonderful thing, because I have no idea how anybody reads these psukim. I don't know how anybody gets past Parshas Bereishis in the Torah. Let's take a look. Story at the end of Bereishis regarding, it's Perek Vov, Pasuk Aleph. I even have all the page numbers written in my notes here, except it's for the other art scroll. This one, the one that you have.
72.
What?
Page 72.
Well, here it's page. No, no, no. Vav. Oh, where am I? 17. Okay, great. Here you go. Here comes a great story that we all just kind of pass over, because like, what does this mean? Vayiki echel ho adam l'rov al pnei adama uvanos yildu lahem. Ah, girls make their appearance, and as soon as they make their appearance, vayiru b'nei ho Elohim es b'nos ho adam, the b'nei ho Elohim, not clear who they are, see these b'nos ho adam ki tovos heina, vayikhu lahem noshim mikol asher b'chor. Right? The age-old problem. Vayomer Hashem, lo yadon ruchi ba'adam le'olam. My spirit will not abide by this forever. Bishegam hu basar, because he's just flesh. V'hayu yamav me'a v'yesrim shana. Now, v'anefilim hayu ba'aretz bayomim ahem. The ones who fell were in the land in those days. The gamach acharechein asher yavo b'neiho Elohim el b'noso Adam, and afterwards, when the b'neiho Elohim will come to the b'noso Adam, the oldulahem and have children, heima ha-giborim asher me'olam anshei Hashem. They are the giborim who were from the day, the olden days, the anshei Hashem, the men of great names. These last couple of psukim are absolutely Tolkien-esque. Nephilim, b'nei Elohim. What's going on here? What's going on? Now, we're talking about Nephilim, and I'll show you in a moment that these are fallen angels, right? The classically famous fallen angels. And it is in this pasuk, directly following the first appearance of the fallen angels, because the B'nei Ho Elohim, as we'll see, the B'nei Ho Elohim and the Nephilim are one and the same. So fallen angels. Directly following the first appearance of the fallen angels, Moshe makes his first appearance in the Torah. So you know, Gemara in Chulin, which is source number 4, asks, Moshe min haTorah minayin? What is the remez to Moshe in the Torah, meaning in the book of Bereishis? As Rashi explains, I think I brought the Rashi too. Minayin l'Moshe remez kodem sheba shesofo lovo, before he was born in Shmos, that he's going to come. The remez is in this pasuk, bishagamu basar. And what's the bishagamu basar? So Rashi explains, you also have it there, bishagam, very strange, not often that we invoke gematria in Rashi, and certainly not often that it is so crucial to such a basic principle, most important drasha, bishagam b'gematria kimo Moshe. Moshe and bishagam add up the same. Uksiv sham, and then right away it says, after bishagam u'basar, v'hayu yamav mea v'yesrim shana, he's going to live 120 years, v'kach hayu yamei chayei Moshe. That's exactly the number of years that Moshe lived. Klomar, it's as if it's saying, it's saying to us, Osid lovo bishegam Moshe min hanolodim v'chein yomav. Somebody is going to be born by the name of Moshe, and these are going to be the days of his life. So let's try and make some sense of this passage here. The Bineho Elohim, literally the sons of the lords, were from among those Malochei Hashores, who argued, and you'll see this in a moment, Mo Enosh Kisis Kerenu. They were from the original Malochei Hashores who argued this. So God challenged them. He said to them, do you think you could do a better job than these Bosor Vidom who you're disdaining, who you're criticizing? So these angels insisted they could, and so they became Nephilim. They were thrown down. They became fallen. They were fallen from heaven to earth. They fell to earth as material beings. And now Geshem. And they immediately behave far worse than man had behaved. Among them were Uzzah va'Azoel, two very famous fallen angels, concerning whom the Gemara says, you have in source 5, Tonadvei Rabbi Yishmael, Azazel, the Sa'ir la'Azazel on Yom Kippur, the word Azazel suggests, Shemachaper al Maisa Uzo va'Azoel. The Sohar HaMishtaleach is coming to be Machaper on the sins of Uzo va'Azoel, who were from among those Malochei Hashores who fell to earth and sinned so grievously. Rashi explains, you have the Rashi there too, Uzo va'Azoel, Malochei Chavolo, destroying angels, Sheyordu la'oretz bimei Na'ama achos tuval kayin. Na'ama was the one who attracted them. And Va'aleim ne'amar, Vayiru b'neiho Elohim, so you see these Malochei Chavolo, who were Nephilim, Uzo va'Azoel, of Azazel fame, they are B'nei Elohim. You see that this is how it's understood. Vayiru B'neiho Elohim as B'nos Ha'adam, Klomar, Al Ha'arayos Mechaper. So the next time you hear the sort of ridiculous pshatim that people give as to why we read the Parsha of Arayos on the afternoon of Yom Kippur, now you'll know why we really read the Parsha of Arayos on the afternoon of Yom Kippur. This is at least the beginning of an explanation. Uzo ma, soyer la'azozel, it's mechaper al ma'isa, uzo va'azoel on Arayos on the Nephilim, the Bnei Elohim. It goes to the very kapora that is necessary on Yom HaKippurim, and we're going to continue to see the importance of this. So, the Bnei Elohim challenged the wisdom of creating man because they were deeply disturbed. They were deeply disturbed by the Bosor aspect. This is our issue. The profound Gashmius that is the essence of the human condition. Now I'm intimidated. Moshe Rabbeinu, who is the very embodiment of Bishagamu Basar, as we saw, he is the living response to the challenge of the angels, as we've seen already. The answer that Moshe provides that seemed to us to beg the question, he wasn't really answering it, he was in fact affirming the question, is actually a penetrating insight into the nature of Torah. Moshe argued that Torah is not accidentally basar oriented. It is oriented to basar in its essence. Moshe explained to them, to the Malachim, how the Torah lives most fully within human relationships, human history, human failure, and human feeling. Basar is not a compromised state in which man is given opportunities in this world to overcome Gashmias and thereby punch his ticket to Olam Haba, which according to this view is the only purpose of life in Olam Hazeh. In fact, and this is a Yesod HaYesodos, in source number 6, I'll actually learn through it with you. The Ramchal argues in the Das Tvunos, a very important passage, that if the, well, let's see it. Let's see it together. Here's the Ramchal from the Das Tvunos. This is a Yesod HaYesodos, this passage. You know, the Das Tvunos is a conversation between the Neshama and the Seichel. So the Neshama has a lot of questions that the Seichel answers. And the Neshama's question at this point is, Adayin Yeshli Mokom Ma'at L'Sheela. I have a little question. Turns out to be the biggest question there is, the one that we've been dealing with. What's this whole yichud jazz that you keep talking about? Yichud, right? Integration, unity. Right? The Ramchal discusses in numerous places, he has another yesod of overarching importance, in which he talks about two hanhogos of HaKadosh Baruch Hu that somehow function simultaneously. There's what he calls the hanhogas ha-mishpat, with which we are familiar. Causal, consequences. Cause and effect. Perform a sin, you get punishment. Perform a mitzvah, you get a reward. But he also talks about a hanhoga, a higher hanhoga, that subsumes the hanhogas ha-mishpat. And he calls this hanhogas ha-yichud. The hanhoga through which the olam actually comes to tikkun. And how these work together, again, this is way beyond the scope of what we're going to discuss here. But the neshama is asking about this relationship, because he asks, what do you need this yichud for? Halo tova hasvara rishona asher shamati mipicha. The first svara I heard from you was plenty good. Betchilas dvorecha. Sherotza HaKadosh Baruch Hu lehetiv hatova shleima el nivrov. HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted to be meitiv. He saw that people needed to earn this hatova, not simply to receive it as a chesed, as a gift. People have to earn it with zechuyos. Al kain som haschar v'ha'onesh ba'olam. He gave schar and onesh in the world. Kedei sheyekablu hatova b'schorom. U'keneged ze som rak Habechira, kedei shiyia mokom l'schar v'onesh. Omar Aseichel. What's wrong with this? What's wrong with saying that this? What do you have? What do we need yichud for? Whatever yichud is exactly, but what do you need it for? So the Seichel says, and here he says some really startling things. Aval ha'maisem ochiach shayichud hua omed lihizgalos. Experientially, you can see that yichud must be revealed. Ki anachnu roim haftochos ha-neviim sheheveinum l'malo kvar. Consider the promises of the neviim that I've already brought previously in the sefer. Asher heim maftichim. Hear this clearly. The neviim say shakodesh baruch hu yigalas Yisrael al kol ponim. The Jewish people are going to experience geula no matter what. Afilu below zichus, even without any merits. And v'sheyotzir yetzer hara mibnei ha'odom v'yachrichem lo'ovdo. He will ultimately remove the yetzer hara and coerce, compel us to serve him. V'hinei kol eilehim neged aschar va'onesh v'neged ha'bechira. These things all fly in the face of these nevuos. They contradict schar va'onesh and bechira. V'yim hoysa ha'kavona be'emes lahamid idyan ha'bechira v'aschar va'onesh. Da'ainu shiyah ha'olam tomid bonui mibnei bechira. If the purpose was that the world should always be built of bnei bechira and schar va'onesh, lios tzadikim or rishoyim kiritzonom, to choose to be tzadikim or rishoyim, the tomid yiyah tov l'tzadikim or ralu rishoyim, hoyot sorech sheze yiyah tomid. Here is the key point that I want to focus on here. Says a number of astonishing things here. But this is what I want to focus on right now. The Ramchal argues, and it's a very compelling argument, that if it was all a matter of schar va'onesh, then the world should be eternal. There should be no 6,000-year plan with a beginning, a middle, and an end. Because v'lo yelo hefsek, it should never stop. If God only wanted hanhogas hamishpat lahamid kol briyosav bo kol ayomim, so then he just would have kept going. Everybody would come on the stage for their 15 minutes, and they'd all experience the same generic challenges, the same obstacles. You'd overcome the obstacles. This is how one of the tzedodim that we presented previously. This is olam hazeh. That's a stage for you to prove whether you can overcome the obstacles or not. That's what gashmius is to ruchnius. It's only a stage for providing challenges and obstacles. And then God has to have a 6,000-year plan because he doesn't have enough real estate in olam haba. He's running out of space. He can't provide a limitless number of people, a limitless number of opportunities for their 15 minutes to earn their olam haba. Obviously he can. The fact that it's a 6,000-year plan means that there's a tachlis, a beginning, a middle, and an end. There's a purpose. It's going somewhere. And if it's going somewhere, it means that of course you're not going to have generic challenges. Every person has different opportunities. Every person has a chance. One aval zeyot, and so on and so forth. I don't want to spend more time reading this. But Moshe explained to them how the Torah lives. Why would God cap the world at 6,000 years? That's the argument of the Mara. The Ramchal. Furthermore, I've already hinted at this, but I want to make it clear. Furthermore, if this is all there is to Olam Hazeh, why is this world, if Olam Hazeh is just a proving ground, why is this world an ever-changing and developing place? Why does life on this planet evolve? What would be the point of constant newness? As I said before, every person should experience the same generic life and undergo the same trials and tests. Now, it is primitive to believe that Olam Hazeh is nothing more than a proving ground. And of course, people will ask the question, which the Ramchal himself addresses in the Mesilas Yeshorim, for those who understand it. What about the Mishnah says, Olam Hazeh is a prose door, Olam Haba? Of course. But if you look carefully at the first parak, Bebir Chovas Ha'odam Ba'olam, in the Mesilas Yeshorim, you'll see that he presents different stages of increasing sophistication of our understanding of what the relationship is between Olam Hazeh and Olam Haba, and Prozdor is just the first and most basic of those relationships. So if Ramchal is correct, and of course he is, Bosor is not a compromise. It is an essential part of the only reality that makes sense. Moshe taught the angels that Torah cannot live as mere information, concepts, ideals, abstractions, or facts. The living Torah requires living humanity, reveling in the universe come alive, rejoicing in the electrochemical thoughts of a human brain, bonded to the soil of which flesh is born and reborn each morning as the first morning, reaching out and communicating joy, pain, and feelings. And the angels accept Moshe's argument to the extent that they understand that if there would not be a Moshe, and there would not be human beings who received the Torah, they themselves would not exist, because there would be no purpose in any creation. However, the story of the Nephilim does not end with the Mabul, because one of the descendants of Uzzah and Azoel survived and remained a threat. That survivor was Og. And at last, we're back to the shiur you came to hear this evening. Okay, it only took 35 minutes. Now, for the sake of accuracy, there was another survivor, Og's brother, Sichon, but that's another story. He's not really relevant to this story directly. Exactly. Now, Og is the one concerning whom it is written. You take a look in Dvorim, Perek Gimel, Pasuk Yud Aleph. Gimel Yud Aleph. Okay, got it. Page 500 in the newer art scroll. Kirak Og Melech Habosha Nishar Miyeser Horifoim. Hine Arso Eres Barzel, Halohi Birabas Bine Amon, Tesha Amos Orko, Faarba Amos Rochbo, Baamas Ish. And the Ramban, which I brought in 7, the Ramban, commenting on this pasuk, says, what is the purpose of all of this, these dimensions of his bed and so on? Like, what do I care about that for? Lahagir al govho v'godlo. We need to know how fearsome looking he was. Ki hoyu harifoyim am godol v'rom ka'anokim. The refoyim, we're going to run into a lot of names now, so hang on. The refoyim were also with this great and powerful nation like the Anakim, like the giants. Now, Moshe himself admits, and this is crucial, Moshe himself admits that he could not deliver the Book of Dvorim, right, which was his last speech to the Jewish people that lasted for 36 days. He couldn't deliver this speech until something very important happened. Look back at Perek Aleph in Devarim, the very beginning. Pasuk Aleph and Pasuk Dalet. Eila hadvorim asher diber Moshe al kol Yisrael be'ever ayardein, etc., etc. Pasuk Dalet. When did he deliver Eila hadvorim? Acharei hakoso esichon melech leamori asher yoshev b'cheshbon v'yaz og melech haboshon Asher Yoshev ba'ashtaros ve'edrei. Moshe couldn't talk. He couldn't say Dvorim until he had dispensed with Sichon and Og. Moshe seems almost obsessed by these ominous adversaries, these giant Rifa'im. Why do I say that? Because if you follow along in the Psukim here, we're going to flip around a little bit, at every single turn, B'nai Yisrael's inheritance of land is made dependent on that territory's specific association with the Rifa'im. So take a look at Perek Beis in Devarim, Pasuk Tes. Says here, Vayomer Hashem Elai, Al Totzar Es Moav Yal Tizgor Ba Milchama, Ki Lo Etein Lechame Arzo Yerusha. You're not going to get Moav as Yerusha. Why? Ki Livnei Lot Nosati Es Or Yerusha. I gave it to Lot. Ha'emim Lifanim Yoshvuba. Am Gadol V'ram, V'ram Ka'anakim. Can't touch that. It's the giants. It's the emim, the ones who strike fear in the hearts of men. And let's take a look at Pasuk Yud Tes, same parak. V'koravtamul b'nei Amon. So you went to Moav, now you go to Amon. Al titzureim v'al tizgor bom. Ki lo etein me'eretz b'nei Amon l'cho yerusha, for the same reason. Ki livnei lot nesatia yerusha. You gotta know, Eretz Rifaim Techashev Afhi. This is also Eretz Rifaim. Rifaim Yoshvu Balifanim. Vahamonim Yikrulahem Zamzumim. Right? They have yet another name. They were called Zamzumim, which sounds pretty scary. Right? And if you look in Rashi on Pasuk Chof, Eretz Rifaim Techashev, Eretz Rifaim Nechsheves Afhi. Lefi shaharifoyim yoshvu balifanim, avolo zuhi shenasati laAvraham. This is not the land of Rifayim that I gave to Avraham, so you can't have this either. And then, if you look at pasuk chav gimel, same page, v'ha'avim hayoshvim b'chatzerim ad aza, kaftorim hayotzim mikaftor hishmidum v'yeshvu tachtom. And let's take a look at the Medrash here, which is brought in Source 8. Medrash and the Gemara in Chulin. So the Medrash says, Hanefilim ayu ba'aretz vayamim ahem, Zayin Shemos nikru lahem. They've got seven names. Emim, Rifoim, Giborim, Zamzumim, Anokim, Avim. And the Gemara says in Chulin, Dovaracher Avim, Shekol haroe osom ochzaso avis. Fear, fright, trembling. And now take a look at Perek Gimel in Devarim. Yud Gimel in Perek Gimel. The Yeser Hagilod v'chol haboshon mamleches og. Nosati lachatzin shevet hamenashe, kol chevel hargov lechol abashon, hahu yikore eretz rifaim. This is also eretz rifaim. However, if you look in Rashi, hahu yikore eretz rifaim, where is the Rashi?
Last Rashi.
Hi oso shenosati li Avraham. Finally, we arrive at the Eretz Rifaim that was promised to Avraham way back when. The other ones weren't, but this one was. So, the book of Dvorim, which is the book of Moshe's personal words, needed, for some reason, to await the defeat of the Rifaim. Og and the Rifaim were linked to Avraham and his grant of Eretz Yisrael through historical ties that frightened Moshe. If you go back in Perek Gimel to the beginning of the Perek, Pasuk Aleph, it says, Vanefen vanal derech haboshon, vayetze og melech haboshon likraseinu, hu v'chol amola milchama edurei, vayomer Hashem elai, al tiro oso, ki biyodchon osati oso, v'yas kol amo v'yas arzo, etc. You look in Rashi on Pasuk Beis. Rashi says, Al tiroso, ubesichon lo hutzrach lomar al tiroso elo misyorei hoya Moshe shelo tamod lo zechus sheshimeish la Avraham. The zechus that Og had earned for serving Avraham. Shenemar vayovo hapalit vehu Og. So, Og was, in the pasuk we read earlier, the only survivor of the remaining Rifaim. And he was the survivor of the war in which Avraham defeated the powerful kings who had defeated the Rifaim. Now, take a look. Sorry again, flipping around here. Bereishis Perek Yudalad, Pasuk Hey. So the Pasuk said, what is it? 39, you said? 36. Okay. Pasuk Hey. Uva Arbaes Reishana Ba Kedor La'Omer. So this is the First World War, right? Between the four kings and the five kings. And Kedor La'Omer and Amlachim Asher Ito Kam Vayaku Es Rifayim Ba'ashturos Karnayim V'yas Hazuzim Bohom V'yas Ho'imim B'shavei Kiryosayim. They wipe out all these Zuzim and Amim and Rephaim. And Rashi says on Zuzim, Haim Zamzumim, which is another name we've come across. Right? So Og became the symbol of the Rephaim, the race of fallen angels, the race of titans, who play a mysterious role in Eretz Yisrael by whatever name they are known. If you don't mind my reference to this, think of Og as the Terminator. He has come down from some other world, and he is going to cause a lot of damage. Until he is finally terminated. Dvorim. I know, I'm sorry. Bamidbar. Yud Gimel Lamed Gimel. Just for another moment. Yud Gimel Lamed Gimel. And the Chumash Ayav, it's 4:18. The Shom Ra'inu, the Meraglim. How did the Meraglim scare the Jewish people? Definitively scare them. V'shom ro'inu es ha'nefilim b'nei anak min ha'nefilim v'anehi be'inenu kachagavim v'chein ho'inu be'ineihem, says Rashi. Actually, I don't want the Rashi. I want the Medrash Rabbah, I think. Rashi brings it. No.
Rabbi? Rashi brings the Kiddush of the Zayv Azal, Shenach the Minash Shemayim.
Rabbi has on his associate, Rabban on Bamidbar, pray to give more.
Yeah, but this is not, it's not what I want. I have a mistake here. It's what we already saw. Okay, it's okay, we saw it already. So, this was the man Moshe needed to face and conquer. The only man he feared. Survivor of a race that triggered primal fears. Avis, who crushed resistance into shuddering. Rifaim, who were remembered for their terror. Amim, and all the other names. The Rifaim, giants, Amim, Zamzumim, were horrific in their own right, but nowhere near as terrifying as the primal founders of their mythos. The Ramban comments, and this is in Source 9. This is why the Meraglim chose to speak about this. Ki mitchila amru v'gam yilidei ha'anak ra'inu sham. V'yachshov, they turn up the pressure a little. Not just yilidei ha'anak. Hifligu bahem likro sam nefilim. They remind them, they're not just big, they're nephilim. V'omru la'om, v'shomru inu es ha'nephilim, shloshes b'nei anak, v'heimen ha'nephilim akadmonim, You remember, these are mythological creatures. These are not just giants. Asher shematem aleim, you've heard about them. Ki hema giborim asher meolam anshei Hashem. Those giborim that we spoke about at the end of Bereishis. Well, if yishohoya inyan anafilim shebedoros noach noda beolam, hiskiru lohem she'elu b'nei ha'anak mehem kidei liyar'om ulevahalom. They mentioned it in a filim, struck fear into their hearts. In the ancient days before the flood wiped out the most powerful roots of evil, there were the Nephilim who brought about the destruction of the world. They thought they were going to love. As we have already seen, they argued against the creation of man. Mo enosh kisis kareno. And the Zohar says, I bring this in source 10, Zohar. Omru Razal, B'shaito debora kudsho brichu la'odom, borolei beginso de'eden, he created him in Gan Eden, v'tzivo al sheva mitzvos. Chov, he sinned, v'yizgaresh beginso de'eden. He's chased out. Utrei malochei shmaya, azov azoel, omru, they said to God, kamei kudsho brichu. This is the medrash I was making reference to before, that I told you we would get to. Ilu havina anon ba'ara, havina zakoin. If we had been on the earth, we would have done proper, we would have behaved properly. So omru le kudsho brichu, v'chi atun yochlin al yitzra bisha. You think you can overcome the yitzra hara? Omru kamei yochlin miyad apilon hakadosh baruch. God throws them down. Kemodat Omar hanefilim hayu baoretz uksiv hagiborim ubeshaita denachso laara o albahu yitzra bisha. Soon as they hit the ground, yitzra hara enters them. Shenemar vayichulahem nashim mikol asher bachoru chovu viisakru mikdush asai. So they sinned, and they were uprooted from their Kedusha. These were the once immortal beings, attracted by the earth's mortal beauty, who turned to evil when they became Bosor. Even though the Mabul was sent to uproot them, and their capacity for Ra, the genes to build the not quite human and fully inhumane Rephoim outlasted the flood because of one polit, one escapee, the one who is identified by the Gemara as the survivor. Vayavoa polit, this is source 11. Vayavoa polit vayaged la'Avraham o'ivri v'amar Reb Yochanan ze og shepolat midor haman. Og was the survivor, the finest specimen that the earth could produce of pure, fierce, and dedicated gashmius, untempered by the softness of humanity. Moshe and Og were destined to face off. A momentous appointment that was made, as we've seen, at the first appearance of the Nephilim, when Moshe was yet a gleam in Earth's future. The Gemara said, remember, traces the first hint to Moshe's existence, long before he appears on the scene in the book of Shmos, to a phrase that appears in the very parsha of the Nephilim. And that pasuk stated, as you recall, "Vayiru b'nos b'nei Elohim es b'nos ha'adam." They took mikol asher b'choru, and Hakadosh Baruch Hu said, "Lo yadon ruchi ba'adam b'shegam hu basar." And b'shegam hu basar is, as the Gemara in Chulin said, a reference to Moshe. And therefore, the hoyu yomav me'av yisrim shana, which is the lifespan of Moshe. So it is. Now, hear this clearly. so it is that Moshe, who is called, if take a look, this is very important to see, in Dvorim, Lamed Gimel, Pasuk Aleph, the very beginning of the very well-known parsha, the Zos HaBrocha, everybody knows it by heart, from Simchas Torah. The Zos HaBrocha, Asher Beirach Moshe, what's he called? Isho Elohim. Oh, that's interesting. That's interesting. Moshe is the Isho Elohim. He was the nemesis of the Rephoim, of the Nephilim, the Bnei Ho Elohim. So the man who begins as Bosor becomes at the end of his life the Isho Elohim, who defeats and uproots finally and absolutely the Bnei Ho Elohim, the Nephilim, who became Bosor. So it turns out that they're mirror images, Moshe and Og. The question before us now is why? Why? Why is Og such, this is the underlying question. Why is Og such a central figure in the Torah story from beginning to end? Why is Moshe so afraid of Og? Why are he and Og such implacable enemies? And why is Moshe's mission not completed until after the defeat of Og? As we saw, he himself says at the beginning of Dvorim, Eila HaDvorim is only Acharei HaKoso Es Og. He's got to get rid of Og before he can say Devorim. In the same way that he had to get rid of the Malachim and their Tainas before he could give the Torah, before he could receive the Torah and give it. So it's rather odd that the Torah describes Moshe first as Bosor, Bishagamu Bosor, and last as Yeshu Elohim, because these descriptions sound incompatible. And as I just pointed out, remarkably, Og is the mirror image of Moshe. He begins, again, as a descendant of the Bnei Elohim, and ends as flesh and blood. And for this reason, the Ramam Ipano calls Og the Oref of Moshe. Right? The Oref is the back of the head. So it's literally, it's like a face-off. It's like there's one creature with two faces. Moshe's face facing frontward, and Og is the Oref facing backward, because they're the mirror image of each other. And not only does Og become Bosor, but unlike his ancestors, the Nephilim, he succeeds at it. And that's the problem. That's why Moshe was so terrified. The proof that he succeeded is that he's the palit. He's the survivor. He survived the mabul that destroyed all the other Nephilim. And therefore, Og terrifies Moshe more than anything or anyone else. Og is the one person who gives the lie to the argument that Moshe presented to the Malachim at Har Sinai. You remember, Moshe had countered the angel's question to God, Mo enosh kisis kirenu, t'no hodcho al ha-shamayim, why are you giving the chamuda genuza, the Torah that preceded the world by 974 generations, why are you giving it to Bnei Adam? And you remember, he defeated their argument by arguing that there must be a commitment to the development of Bosor, for the relationship between Bosor and Ruach to work. This means, so here we come to the core concept. This means that the relationship develops from the bottom up, beginning with Bosor, that ideally will be perfected to the point that it emerges as Ruach. Moshe is the paradigm for that process. beginning, as we just said, as Bishagamu Basar, and ending as Yeshua Elohim. Og's success as a Bnei Elohim, who becomes Basar, seemingly disproves Moshe's argument. The relationship between Basar and Ruach, Og proves, is not unidirectional. It doesn't go in just one direction. It doesn't only work from the bottom up. Og proves that it's multi-directional. It works from the top down also. You can start at the top and go down. And top down sounds much better than bottom up. Because, after all, how can you compare a feeble and insignificant human to a robust and majestic angel? And so, just as Moshe could not receive the Torah at Har Sinai until he defeated the argument of the angels, he cannot complete the Torah by writing the book of Devarim until he neutralizes the threat of Og, as he himself says. And this then is the one the question that remains to us tonight. How does Moshe neutralize the threat that Og represents? So this is the last idea. Wow. So I always say when I get to the end that we've reached the end, but I never give a hint as to how long the end takes. But anyway, this is the last idea. You'll recall that we began the shiur with what is perhaps the most important of all the philosophical questions, of which I would like to remind you: what is the relationship between physicality and spirituality? Ruchnius and Gashmius. And I asked different ways of putting it. Is it an adversarial relationship? Is it a mutual relationship? A relationship of antagonists? Or is it a symbiotic relationship? And we said another way of putting it is, what's the relationship between Olam Hazeh and Olam Haba? And is Olam Hazeh just a static stage on which we play out this game of overcoming challenges in order to earn a place in Olam Haba? Or is Olam Hazeh a field of dynamic opportunity on which we create our own identities, and therefore our unique chelek in Olam Haba? The answers to these questions depend on how you think about the relationship between physicality and spirituality. Do you think about the relationship as Moshe did, or do you think about it as Og did? In other words, how is the relationship between physicality and spirituality achieved? Is it achieved bottom-up or top-down? Og and the Bnei HaElohim believed that life on earth consists of using the intellect to overcome the challenges presented by Gashmius. It is the ascendance of the intellect over the body, in the classic sense of the expression we use, mind over matter. In other words, Olam Hazeh is a static stage on which we play games of the mind to overcome the challenges presented by Gashmius so that we may earn a place in Olam Haba. Og feels this way because his basar isn't where he came from. His basar is artificial. And as a result, Og is history's first Frankenstein. He does not embody the nature of creation. He does not possess an essential connection to his Gashmius. He inhabits his Gashmius. And like all famous demons of literature, from Sauron to Voldemort, he controls it, but he does not identify with it. The earth is his adversary. The flesh is his antagonist, and it is nothing other than an obstacle to be overcome on the way to Olam Haba. Moshe, on the other hand, drives home a very different approach in his argument with the Malachim. He contends that life on earth must come from a mother and father. It must come from the earth from which humanity sprang. Remember, Adam is so named because he came from Adama. He is called human because of the humus, the organic matter from which he is constituted. He identifies completely with the earth and with his flesh, and therefore the pasuk in Tehillim says, brought in source 12, Olisa lamorom shavisa shevi, I cited this pasuk already, Lokachta matanos ba'adam, you went on high, you captured, you've taken captives and gifts, how? Ba'adam, because of Adam, you are Adam, you're Adam. Moshe succeeded in turning the hostile angels into his lovers because he was Adam. He persuaded them that life on earth must begin with Adama, with flesh and blood. The earth is not a mere proving ground. Rather, it is a field of dynamic prospects that evolves along with man while providing him endless opportunity for development. Moshe explains that the meaning of all avoda, listen to this carefully, the meaning of all avoda, the meaning of all that we do, lies in the utilization of Adama. Adam is placed in Gan Eden for what purpose? Right? The Pasuk says in Perek Beis, Pasuk Tezvav, in Breishis, Lo'ovda Ulishomra. This is the purpose of life on earth. And listen to the definition of Le'ovda. So take a look back at that Pasuk, actually. Perek Beis Pasuk. Hey. And we're going to take a look at the Rashi. Perek Beis Pasuk. Hey. V'chol siach hasoda terem yeh ba'oretz. V'choleisev hasoda terem yitzmach. Ki lo himtir Hashem Elokim alo oretz v'odom ayin lavod es ha'adoma. Says Rashi. V'choleisev hasoda adayin lo tzomach. This is Rashi, is based here on a Gemara, very famous. U'bashlishi shekosu v'totzei ha'oretz. It's a contradiction, the Gemara asks. Gemara in Chulin. It says on day 3 that Vatotzei Oretz Desha, all the grass came out. So why is it saying here on day 6 that it hadn't come out yet? So El al Pesach Karka Omdu Ad Yom Shishi. The grass just came to the surface of the earth on day 3. But it didn't sprout until day 6. Why? Ki lo himtir. Umatam lo himtir. Why was there no rain? There was no one to recognize the goodness of rain. When man came and was cognizant of the fact that they were needed for the world, they fell, he was mispalel, the rain fell, and everything sprouted. The elements of physicality, and I've used this word numerous times here, known in Lashon HaKodesh as Gashmius, are expressed in creation as rain, which of course is known as Geshem. The question with which we started, the relationship between Ruchnius and Gashmius, preoccupied the first 10 Doros from Adam to Noach. Their solution was to attempt to overcome physicality with their intellects. The result was the Mabul and the destruction of life on earth. Noach was the lone human survivor. Here I want to tell you a very radical pshat. You remember what Noach did when he emerged from the Teva? What did he do? Planted a vineyard. got drunk. Vayochel Noach Isha Adom. So, well, give me the translation. Oh, you don't have the translation? It's also all Hebrew. Does anybody have the English one? Nobody has an English Chumash? All right, it's okay. Doesn't matter. The translation in the art scroll is as you would expect it. Vayochel Noach Isha Adoma. Something to the effect of he profaned. His behavior was profane. Was chulin. I want to suggest to you that Noach did this because in the aftermath of the Mabul, he was utterly committed to be the Ish HaAdama. It says, Vayochel Noach Ish HaAdama. That was his commitment. He wasn't Ish HaElohim. No, that's what caused the whole problem. He wasn't Bnei Elohim. That's what caused the whole problem. He's Vayochel Noach Ish HaAdama. By planting a vineyard and getting drunk, Noach demonstrates that he does not lord it over the Adama. His brain does not define the Adama. The Adama defines his brain. The extent to which it defines his brain is revealed by seeing the effect on his brain when he imbibes, when he drinks a product of the earth. Noach declares, after the disaster of the first 10 generations, his intellect does not exist outside and independent of the Adama. His brain is basar. It's a meat brain. It's flesh, as much as any other part of him. The people of the first 10 generations, they became Bnei HaElohim because they embraced the idea that their intellects were independent of the Adama. And this is precisely what the Rifoyim thought. They rejected the true nature of Adama and decided to rule over it. They concluded that Basar was to be viewed as a drawback, an obstacle, a negative, a weakness to be overcome. Noach refused to accept this point of view. According to the Medrash, this is in Source 13, he dedicated himself to be a farmer. For the pure love of farming, Ish HaAdama, says the Medrash, burgur l'shem burgarus. It's an English word, we use it also, a burger. I don't mean a hamburger, a burger. He's a man of the earth, a burger. B-E-R, not B-U-R, a burger. Burgur l'shem burgarus. Why was he named Noach? Remember what the Torah says. He's named Noach because Zeyin Achameinu, he was the one who invented the plow. He discovered better ways to farm. This is what he dedicated his life to. It was his attitude that allowed him to be Motzei Chen Beinei Hashem and to be the one who would sail the seven seas in his teva and become the intrepid explorer who would be the first to glimpse the new world. So, genuinely to finish, the fundamental question of the value of Basar goes all the way back to Moshe and the words that hint to his future life, Bishagamu Basar. The value of Basar was decided in a clash of titans in which Moshe was the victor over Og. That proved that the earth is not merely a stage on which we strut for a few moments to try to overcome the obstacle of flesh and punch our tickets to Olam Haba. Rather, the earth itself and all flesh demands development and requires tikkun. And we are here to accomplish that tikkun. And in that accomplishment, we discover our own identity and the meaning of our existence. And if you can hang on for just another 2 minutes, I just want to share with you, you don't have to, but I came across this article, and it's an article from the New York Times magazine, so you shouldn't be chayshim b'ksheirim, I don't read the New York Times or the New York Times magazine. I came across it on the internet, which is, I guess, an even bigger chashav than reading the New York Times. Maybe I should have quit when I was ahead. Okay. The article is entitled the AI awakening, artificial intelligence. Now listen to this. We're coming to the end of the 6,000 years, right? I mean, it's like amazing. Since the term artificial intelligence was first coined at a kind of constitutional convention of the mind at Dartmouth in the summer of 1956, a majority of researchers have long thought the best approach to creating AI would be to write a very big, comprehensive program that laid out both the rules of logical reasoning and sufficient knowledge of the world. So as an example, if you wanted to translate from English to Japanese, you would program into the computer all of the grammatical rules of English, and then the entirety of definitions contained in the Oxford English Dictionary, and then all of the grammatical rules of Japanese, as well as all of the words in the Japanese dictionary, and only after all of that, feed it a sentence in a source language and ask it to tabulate a corresponding sentence in the target language. Now, there are two main problems with this old-fashioned approach. The first is that it's awfully time-consuming on the human end. The second is that it only really works in domains where rules and definitions are very clear. In mathematics, for example, or chess. Translation, however, is an example of a field where this approach fails horribly, because words cannot be reduced to their dictionary definitions, and because languages tend to have as many exceptions as they have rules. More often than not, a system like this is liable to translate minister of agriculture as priest of farming. There has always been another vision for AI. Now get this, a dissenting view in which the computers would learn from the ground up, from data, rather than from the top down, from rules. This notion dates to the early 1940s, when it occurred to researchers that the best model for flexible automated intelligence was the brain itself. A brain, after all, is just a bunch of widgets called neurons that either pass along an electrical charge to their neighbors or don't. What's important are less the individual neurons themselves than the manifold connections among them. This structure, in its simplicity, has afforded the brain a wealth of adaptive advantages. The brain can operate in circumstances in which information is poor or missing. It can withstand significant damage without total loss of control. It can store a huge amount of knowledge in a very efficient way. It can isolate distinct patterns, but retain the messiness necessary to handle ambiguity. An artificial neural network could do something similar by gradually altering on a guided trial and error basis the numerical relationships among artificial neurons. It wouldn't need to be pre-programmed with fixed rules. It would instead rewire itself to reflect patterns in the data it absorbed. This attitude, get this line, amazing. This attitude toward artificial intelligence was evolutionary rather than creationist. If you wanted a flexible mechanism, you wanted one that could adapt to its environment. If you wanted something that could adapt, you didn't want to begin with the indoctrination of the rules of chess. You wanted to begin with the very basic abilities, sensory perception and motor control, in the hope that advanced skills would emerge organically. Humans don't learn to understand language by memorizing dictionaries and grammar books, so why should we possibly expect our computers to do so? A very ancient machlokas, indeed. Indeed. Og and Moshe. Bottoms up or top down? And as we get closer to the month of Adar, it's always great to focus on bottoms up.